Going to speak in English, but just to give you the information, how we proceed now. Wir werden jetzt 20 Minuten ungefähr hier.
Which means we will have about a 20-minute debate among us here on stage. And then there will be another song. And then we will have another 15 minutes for Q. And I guess there are a number of questions in the audience.
Thank you very much for these really great presentations tonight. I have to say I am a non-expert. I am not an economist. So I try to make some sense out of what is happening in the world of economy and finance and of what you have said tonight. But I would really like to start basically with the theme of the day. When you read the economic pages of newspapers, the big story today is Bitcoin. What I get out of Bitcoin is, what you can read in the papers is that it is a system based on computation and the energy used to compute at the moment. Bitcoin is about the energy you have to use for the nation state of Serbia. So there's a lot of infrastructural energy used to keep this system going. This is one aspect. Second aspect is, as far as the technology is concerned, it's based on blockchain technology, and it would be great to have some idea or some comments on blockchain technology from your side. And then there's a third aspect which becomes very interesting for me when I look at economy of today. And your talk, Karin Knorr-Cetina, is this relationship on the one side between mathematics and rationality, and on the other side, completely irrational aspects of these developments. And as far as Bitcoin is concerned, my question is this just a belief system based on energy consumption?
So I'll take maybe Bitcoin firsthand. I don't want to be an expert, say I'm an expert on blockchain by any means, but I think with Bitcoin in particular, the value is what, $16,000 or something? I forget what it's at now. It changes every hour, who knows? But I think the value is nobody knows, and it is based upon beliefs. It's a classic sort of bubble situation of people think that other people believe its value is this particular amount. But Bitcoin fundamentally has no intrinsic value to it. So it's sort of interesting when we think about maybe disaggregating the nature of markets in the way that Phil did, is to think about the price discovery mechanism for Bitcoin isn't there, that we're still trying to search for the price of Bitcoin, the sort of value of Bitcoin, and where it's going to end up, nobody knows. People have beliefs about where it's going to end up, but of course nobody actually knows. But I think also what's more interesting is the blockchain technology behind it, which fits, I think, very nicely in with this evolutionary perspective, thinking about the way in which markets are evolving and the way in which the different submodules of them are changing. Blockchain is about an innovation in some of those elements, whether it be record keeping or whether it be about clearing and settlement and these sorts of aspects. That's fundamentally what the blockchain is all about. On the energy issue, I'll maybe just quickly say, Bitcoin is based upon massive energy. A lot of blockchain stuff is based upon massive energy use, but it's not the only way to do these things. So they're based upon what's called a proof of work system. So it involves, you know, you have to solve a computational problem. That expends energy, and that's what makes them function. But there's alternative ways of doing that proof which aren't as energy inefficient.
What one is reading also as an informant, let's say, newspaper reader, is that there are fears by economists now that to some extent the Bitcoin market is not so much connected with the rest of the markets, but it gets more and more integrated into other markets. And if it collapses at some point, that may have really severe effects on the whole system. Can you say something about that, Phil?
Part of the story that I was telling is that more complicated markets, more complex in the computational terminology markets, simulate the activity of less computationally complex markets. And that's precisely what a futures market is doing to a spot market, right? And it has to be more computationally complex because if there are other determinants of the price, that they have to be tracked. But then there's that intervening problem that there's further things going on with this the relationship of this market to other markets that the futures market has to, in some sense, track. So long story short is that, yes, having a futures market for Bitcoin does offer the possibility of undermining other markets, precisely because now the simulation and interlinkage is going on. So that's a little bit disturbing. See, I mean, if it wasn't Bitcoin, suppose it was like, I don't know, you know, you could just call it Coke bottle tops or something like that. It wouldn't matter all that much. But the fact that some people want to treat it as though it were a currency, and then, of course, start building futures markets in the same way that you have a futures market for state currencies, does create problems.
I think there's also, there was a recent news story about people taking mortgages out to invest in the Bitcoin market, which is a very clear connection between different markets. I don't think it's happening on any sort of major level, but that is a bit worrying.
I want to connect your talk on financial markets with your solution of decommodification of labor. When I heard both of your talk, I was thinking what role, what power labor still plays in the markets. Because if I look on financial markets, the speed of trading is so fast because of the algorithms. And of course, these markets, the financial markets, are intervening into the rest of the markets to a great extent. So the question is, what is the power relation between, let's say, labor in the markets and the algorithms, so to say, the power of the algorithms? And is the transformation and decommodification of labor good enough to challenge the system? Or is the system basically just another system already?
I think you are pointing the finger on the right thing. So this decommodification happens already. You know, if people lose their job to algorithms, for example, you may not find it well covered with the concept of decommodification, but in fact, they don't have to do this work anymore. They are redundant, as you say, and we come up with these solutions of a general income or something like that in response to the fact that there is no work that's ready for them. If you create a self-driving car, which will be upon us in 5 years or so, the prediction goes, so it's not far away at all. It's already there. You will remove tens of thousands of workers in the United States that make an income, maybe much more, hundreds of thousands, that make an income is either with low skills because they can't do anything else, or because of organizational difficulties, or because in the area in which they were competent, there is no job available. And these people made a living doing just that. They won't need to do that anymore because the car will drive itself. So I think decommodification, not under this euphemistic concept, is already happening in the negative sense you don't have a market for your job anymore. You don't have a market for your skills anymore. Yeah. You don't have a market for what you could offer.
Yeah. So the financial markets take over the political strategies of your proposal?
Well, so I don't think that's decommodification. Being unemployed, you're still a commodity. You still have to sell your labor power in the market in order to make any income. So I don't think unemployment is decommodification in any way. So we need to be careful about that. But I do think that there is a sense in which, and you mentioned Brian Arthur's work on the second economy, I think there is really the sense in which the market is becoming the second economy, where humans figure as maybe adjuncts to the process at best. But increasingly, it's run by algorithms, through algorithms, globally, and we're just sort of, you know, the appendages of this machine. And at that point, the question becomes, well, who's winning between technology and labor, and how do they sort of interact? Well, I think that capitalism, is, again, is a social system. It's not just an economic system. And once we take into account not just the sort of measured aspects of the economy that get taken into account by GDP and stuff like that, once we start taking into account that people are dependent on the market for an income, we start to realize that we have to fight against that. We have to struggle against that. We have to develop ways to respond to these challenges.
Reading also some of your stuff on trading, there was one point you made, which I think is very important to look at, is that even up to now, not anymore companies, neither states are the major actors in the markets, but it's traders or quants now, nowadays. These are the agents in the system, as you describe it, at least. So the question is, what kind of political strategy one could develop in order to transform really the system? Even if I think of different kind of markets, it seems that the power at the moment is so much on the financial market side that there is no alternative market developing such kind of power. So do we have to get rid of financial markets on the basis of algorithms at all?
If I can, well, and so it all depends on whether you have a revolutionary strategy and believe in it, or more of a reformist strategy, because there are huge difficulties. It would be nice to, and I understand fully what you say about decommodification not being what I said, but one has to factor in also other questions. What are people going to do with their time? Are they getting the land back and spending it like we did 500 years ago? Or will there be a problem? Will they end up like the Indians in their reservations, you know, with some pension and alcoholism pervasive and not knowing what to do pervasive because the old culture isn't there and the new one isn't adopted? So there are huge problems, but your question was about... What? Your question was about the... financial markets. I believe that financial markets are really about credit and how we create more credit through mobilizing money. People have pension funds, for example, that shouldn't sit there and be idle, not work, but that should be made to work for us. And this money can be used to buy into the future, for example. Credit is about the future, and Marx said that, others said that, about creating the future in the now. If I get credit, I can build the house now, and I don't have to wait until I'm 60 and have the savings to build a house for myself. There's something very persuasive about some of that, but of course the other side of it is that sometimes the markets begin to dictate what the future looks like, because it's particular sorts of markets which then invest the money into future things. But I think if I would have a reformist strategy, I would not, was Luhmann mal sagte, mit spitzen Fingern, I would eliminate credit markets with a lot of caution. Because, you know, you do run the risk of eliminating too much of a system that rests completely on credit, or very largely on credit, and without the capacity of thinking through all the consequences. So that's better left to real revolution where people don't think and just kill or some such, and then build it up from scratch. But if you have to think it through and be sure you have it right, I would be hesitant about that, I'm afraid.
But when the allocation of money and the future is basically done by algorithms more and more, you, to some extent, you said, to some extent, 50% of the trading is already done by algorithms, which are not anymore 100% controlled by humans. And that means the allocation of the future, not just in the digital world of finance, but also in the real world to some extent. What are the implications for, let's say, political systems? What are the implications for social discourse on how to allocate the future?
Well, maybe see, I think we could imagine a future where these algorithms are designed not to make profit for a handful of people, but instead to designed to collectively benefit us all. And I don't think there's anything, intrinsically impossible about that sort of scenario. It's politically difficult to imagine how we get there, but we could use these algorithms and these financial markets in ways that are much better suited to general benefit of people instead of just a few.
I don't like to talk at these kind of grand levels. I mean, I would say that the repo market is really screwed up, however. You see, I mean, if we could get really specific, I would say that the repo market is built on a fatal flaw, and that has become so central to the elaboration of credit that I could imagine a world where we just kind of put a stop to repo by requiring real collateral and not collateral that, you know, exists someplace in the sky somewhere. And you know, you would still have credit, but it would look different. So the trouble with those kind of questions is that you really have to start getting down into the specifics and the weeds. You know, there's no such thing as waving your hand and getting rid of finance, but you know, there was a world without repo 20 years ago. It's not so hard to imagine what that world looks like. So,
yeah, I would fully agree. Indeed, one has to look where, because the futures market and the options market, they don't come out of late capitalism. They come out of very early agricultural attempts, you know, to hedge against risks, for example. They made a lot of sense that way. And therefore, one has to get specific and see where is the outgrowth, the metastatic sort of thing that doesn't really make sense anymore, and then to do something. And to some degree, I think finance has taken a hit in the last years because of new regulations, because of migration out of financial markets, but also because of, I think, the population starting to think about this more, and sometimes government preventing, for example, Korea, building in mechanisms that slow down these markets. Some of that has to be done by government. And I do not understand why our governments, which after all still exist and are lawmakers, why none of them, you know, makes any attempt to stop, and maybe this is something, I hope you don't understand that as something I say against what you said, to stop so many people losing their job through, for example, self-driving cars and things. Why this is not automatically a benefit before we have a solution for these people and what they do afterwards? You know, this is first you have to find a solution for labor that's unqualified but makes a reasonable living by driving cars, for example. If you don't have that solution, you should not invest as a government, I think, into enhancing self-driving car technology. You should use the sort of mechanisms they use all the time, you know, putting a tax on it, saying it can only drive on the street if it has these and these and these qualifications, which are not reasonable. You don't have to stop capitalism that way, but you can slow down and stop things that are happening that will create a turnover, a deprofessionalization, a de-skilling, you know, for which we yet do not have a solution. And the government can think about solutions, about retraining. These are all reformist strategies, but they would be possible now. And no government I know, not the social democratic ones here, and of course not the capitalist ones over there in the US, make the slightest effort, it seems to me, to even think about it.
And you would say that state governments could be the major actors to reframe?
Well, they could certainly, they could stop the currency market, which is a $5.1 right now trillion dollar in English trillion. So in German, I think it's billions dollars every day of turnover, of trading. This is by far the largest market worldwide. Of course, they can stop it. They can fix the currency rate. This has its own problems, so I'm not recommending that you fix the currency rates here, because we know what the problems are. We know it in Greece, for example. We have to find alternatives for that, but they can do it if they want to do it. It's not that they cannot do it.
I think the only time we saw that happen, though, where states controlled global finance, was after the Great Depression and after World War II and the devastation of these things.
Yes.
When the international community decided that actually we have to do something and came together, tried to implement the Bretton Woods system, which never even really properly functioned and broke down 20 years later.
Yeah.
So I don't know that this actually works. I think this is a fundamental problem, that states don't have that sort of power to do that sort of thing.
No, they have the power, I said. I didn't say they have the skill. Maybe you have to take a little bit of the theory of knowledge being distributed into account there, and they may not have the skill to do it. Yes.
Okay, we close here. We now hear the choir for last time, and then you have the possibility of asking questions.